Welcome to A Path Home. This is the podcast where we demystify the tasks related to after-death care through hearing stories from people who have cared for their own deceased loved ones at home. I'm your host, Sarah Cruz. With just 22 episodes since we launched in October, we have already exceeded 5,000 downloads. We are so grateful to all of you who are listening and spreading the word. I'll be taking a short break to line up more of these inspiring conversations, and we'll be back with a new season before you know it. For this final episode of season one, I have a heartbreaking and beautiful conversation with Marianne Dietzel, who tells the story of the home funeral for her daughter Nina and Nina's best friend Kirsten. Marianne went on to write a book about her journey with grief, and along with Kirsten's mother, Linda Berg, was a founding member of the Minnesota Threshold Network, a death care collective and educational group based in the Twin Cities. I'll share links for both in the show notes. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning, Sarah.
It's so nice that you're here, and I'm just super grateful that you're joining me today to share your story on A Path Home. Your story is one of tragedy and pain and of spiritual reckoning and healing. Your daughter Nina was killed in a car accident when she was 18.
Right. Just 18.
Mm-hmm. Just 18. And you published a memoir about your journey through grief called Laughing in a Waterfall. And I want to talk about that process a little later in our conversation. But to get started, will you please tell us a little bit about Nina and also the event that changed your life and pointed you towards the work you do today?
I'm happy to share this story. Even 20-some years after, it's still, of course, very alive for me.
What year was the accident?
The accident was in 1996. Nina was the first child born in my family. She has two brothers. Kevin is 2 years younger, and Soren is 13 years younger than Nina. And Nina went to a Waldorf school for her first kindergarten and eighth grades of schooling. And for those who don't know what that is, it is an international independent private school movement that is very holistic, with the arts very integrated and developmentally based. So there, she was in the same class as her friend Kirsten. And one class stays with a teacher for 8 years.
That's amazing.
It is, yeah. But we had a break in there because our family moved to a Camp Hill village, which is a farming intentional community that includes adults with developmental disabilities. So we actually lived there for 5 years with people with disabilities in our home with us. And Nina loved it there, as did Kevin. Our younger son was born when we were living there. And she had really good friends there, but she did keep up with her friend Kirsten. And Kirsten's family, after eighth grade, so she stayed with the Waldorf school class, but then her family went to France for a year. When they got back from France, our family moved back from Camp Hill Village, which is in central Minnesota, to the Twin Cities. And Kirsten's family was back from France, so they both started off high school. So they were both going to public schools. They had 2 years of that. And then in the summer, they went to a youth conference for graduates of Waldorf schools. They got permission to go, being a little bit younger. They came back from that just fired up again about Waldorf education. And they said, we have to finish our high school years at a Waldorf high school. They really missed all the arts, and just the whole approach was so different. So they worked very hard and figured out how to get themselves to a small town, 2 hours north of New York City, kind of close to Albany. And there was a Waldorf school there in this small town. And Nina's godmother lived there. Her husband taught in the Waldorf school. So they had a connection there, which is ultimately why they decided to go to that school. And we agreed, although dragging our feet a little bit, because we thought we had another year with our daughter at home. But they were really determined. So there was a teacher whose two boys had gone off to college, so that they had bedrooms available and offered that so they could both live in the same house. And it was up this hill. It's a kind of a hilly region, and right across from the campus of the school. And then you went up this gravel road where there were houses all along, and near to the top was the house where they lived. So they were quite famous for walking up and down this hill together to and from school every day, and many people driving in would see them. And this was really a dream come true for them, and they really, really were aware of that. They were living in the country, which they loved. They were at this Waldorf school doing all the artistic work, which they loved, and meeting new friends, and they had places to walk around, and they were just very, very happy.
Wow. They were living the dream. They had, you know, they worked really hard to get there, and there they were.
They did. So I went to visit once in early November. We went to visit a few colleges in the area. Kirsten's mother, Linda, went to visit on Thanksgiving. So the day after Thanksgiving, they arranged to borrow a car because the girls wanted to go into the nearest bigger town where they had a Salvation Army or something like that. They wanted to go shopping. So Kirsten was driving. Her mom was sitting in the passenger seat, and Nina was behind Linda. So they took off on the country road past the school and a few miles down the curvy road. And they came, I can't remember if it was it was kind of a hill. There was supposedly black ice that day. It wasn't like snowing, but it was November, so it was freezing. So there was black ice. So Kirsten crossed the center line, and a semi truck was coming up the hill and couldn't stop. So that's how the accident happened. So the truck hit the car on that side and threw Kirsten back into Nina's lap.
Oh my gosh.
And somebody following them right away called the ambulance. You know, they had to go knock on a neighbor's door because this was before cell phones. The people that they had connected with there, some of the adults, like Nina's godmother. It was amazing. Her one of the woman's husband was driving by there and came home and said, "I saw the car that the girls were in, and I'm afraid they were in an accident." So Laura and Cecilia, these two moms, drove to the accident site, and they were actually there with them, which was so amazing for us.
Wow.
The ambulance had already come, and Linda, they had to get her out with the jaws of life, and she was then helicoptered into Albany to the medical center. So Linda lived, but the two girls were killed instantly. So, yeah, that's...
It's just overwhelming. Like, it's the... you know, kind of nightmare scenario that any parent can imagine.
Absolutely. It totally is. And then, so Laura somehow got home, and the accident was about 11:20. And, you know, she was back home by about noon and called my husband at work. And he came home and was waiting there. I was with my younger son off doing some errands or something. And he met us in the basement stairs where we come in from the car, and he had an Afghan on, and he walked us upstairs. "I have something to tell you." And of course my mind is going all sorts of places, but never would I have imagined what really happened. So that's how I found out. And yeah, right away, well, very soon, we started calling people. And Nina's friend Bethany lived around the corner, who she went to public high school with, and she came up with her dad, and another friend lived nearby. And so we had a lot of support, being so far away in Minnesota.
Right. Oh, right. Devastating.
Yeah. Soon, we got our wits together and, had a friend help us book a flight, and he actually paid for the flight for us to go there in the morning. So that would be Saturday morning. But also during that day, Laura, this is Nina's godmother, called us and asked us what our wishes were. And I have to tell you of a little background at this town called Harlemville, where the Waldorf school was. It was also home to a large biodynamic farm that was also a teaching farm and had a farm store connected to it. There was a Christian community church there. And so Waldorf schools, biodynamic agriculture, and the Christian community movement for religious renewal are all kind of sister movements that were inspired by the philosophy of Rudolf Steiner.
Mm-hmm.
Steiner, in his teachings about the journey of the soul after death, has explained that at that time, the soul sees a panorama of life, of their life, not in chronological order, but just a grand tableau of pictures of your life. And these, the first 3 days, while that picture lasts, this is the time that the soul is transitioning, the spirit is transitioning to the other world. But that viewing this panorama of your life is a very important part of their journey. And that this time should be a time of peace and quiet, where you don't want to be handling the body yet, let alone, you know, pumping out all the liquids and for embalming.
Right.
And not cremating right away either. So it's a very right. sacred time, these 3 days. So people in this community had put that into practice. And so they already had a funeral home who knew about keeping the body in a home to have a wake. So Laura just wanted to know if how we wanted them buried. And we said we wanted them cremated, but that a pine box to lie them in for the wake is what we wanted, you know. So that's what she wanted to know. So she got busy talking to the woodwork teacher to find somebody who would build these coffins for these two girls.
It's extraordinary that they were there in that community.
I know.
Who was so ready to
and embrace them and hold them.
Yeah.
Yeah. We also knew about this in a practical way, because the year before, Kirsten's father, Linda's husband, actually died of a heart attack. He had this heart attack on the street and was taken to the hospital and was on life support. And during that time, Linda said, you know, I really want this to be more personal. Let's figure out how we can bring Paul home to have a wake there. So I called some people who might have known about that. So we did a lot of research on how to make that happen. So Paul had a home vigil, which our whole community was involved in the year before. And so here, Linda's only child is now in a car accident. So we knew, and we were speaking for Linda too, we knew that a home funeral was what we wanted. So it all just unfolded from there. Cecilia, one of the other moms of the friends of Nina and Kirsten, offered her living room.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, was Linda like in the ICU during all this?
She was
gravely injured.
She was gravely injured. She had to go through something like an 18-hour surgery to have her face rebuilt.
Oh my gosh.
And she lost an eye on the left side, you know, because the impact was from the left. And, you know, said some pelvic injuries and, you know, quite a few traumatic injuries. So she, we stopped in at after we arrived in the airport, we stopped by and I believe someone had told her. So she was conscious enough that she was able to ask. She was so concerned, you know, to find out that the girls had died. And amazingly, some friends of hers who were about to go on a trip to Mexico heard about this. They changed their tickets and flew to Albany to camp out in Linda's room. And he was actually a doctor, so it was extremely helpful that we knew that Linda would be taken care of so we could then go to Harlemville and be present at the wake. But first there was the body washing. And I was just in the airport as we waited for Laura to come and get us. I was just so desperate to see Nina and found out when Laura finally came, I found out that she was late because she had gone with someone else to the funeral home and had prepared the bodies with the funeral directors because what they thought was, it's in a basement. I can't imagine that this is where these girls' parents would want to first see their child who had just died in an accident. So it was totally out of goodwill that she did that. You know, that was hard for me because I wanted to do that.
Mm.
So the girls' bodies waited there and different people came and sat with them in the basement of the funeral home while the coffins were being built. And then while we were waiting for the glue to dry. So it gave us time to get back to Harlemville, to have some supper, put our younger son, Soren, to bed because he was only 4 at the time. And finally, then like at 11 o'clock, or maybe we went over there sooner than that. But the girls, finally, it arrived at something about 11 o'clock.
Arrived at the
at house? The house, yes.
Where the vigil would be?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they were brought in on stretchers. And my husband, Dennis, wanted to help carry them in because for him, it was important to feel the weight of her body.
Mm-hmm.
And the coffins, I think they came in through the window because they didn't fit through the door or something. So the coffins were there and Cecilia helped us get blankets to lie them in. And I remember that the coffins were kind of deep that it looked like they were too far down. So it would be hard for people to see them. So Cecilia kept going and getting more blankets to build it up a little bit. And finally, you know, we put the girls in there and got them arranged with a sheet to cover their bodies. And Nina barely looked scathed from the accident. And, you know, I could hardly believe it. How could she die such a violent death and not show it? But she didn't. You know, because she didn't get scratched or anything. Kirsten had a little more scratches around her face or bruises or something. Karen Frischkoff, the woman who lived where the girls lived, she chose the clothing for the girls. So that was all done. But there was Nina lying on a sky blue quilt, and she had blonde hair, and she just looked beautiful.
Mm. So you were able to, you know, you weren't there for the washing, but you were able to hold her and touch her and stroke her hair and
yes,
those sorts of things.
Yes. And then there was another family who was really close to Kirsten, came from Boston, and they kind of did that for Kirsten. And then another family arrived and they had a daughter who was a little younger than girls, but was also very close to them. So when they finally arrived, then they did more, you know, put flowers in Kirsten's hair and tended to her more. And all the high school students had gathered in this room, in this house. And Kevin right away was sort of embraced by these high school students who he had never met.
How old was Kevin?
He was 15. So we had some time there before the bodies came, and it allowed us to kind of meet some of these high schoolers. And we actually got inspired to lead them in this little dance. Spiraling into the center of the shield. Spiraling into the center of the shield. I am the weaver. I am the woven one. I am the dreamer. I am the dream. So it goes on like that, and it just has this little all joining hands, and we led them in a spiral and then led them out of the spiral. So that was amazing to connect with them all like that.
Yeah.
When the bodies were finally in, the high schoolers all went upstairs and let us have some time alone. But then the whole 3 days, people came, they left, they came back. I mean, it was just the place to be. People really could experience what a peaceful and wondrous thing this was to be able to say goodbye and watch the soul leaving this body, so that by the end of the 3 days, you're really, I felt ready, that I had had that time. And, you know, all this beautiful poetry was written and songs were sung, the lyre was played and other instruments, and so much beauty. Somehow I was finally ready after the 3 days to say the final goodbye. So the Christian community priest came for the first part of the service. The funeral was to close the coffin. So there's a ritual around that. And kind of the tight circle of the family who had all come from Minnesota and other places where our family all spread out lives. And they sprinkle holy water on the bodies. And then the time comes to close the coffin. And here again, Dennis was ready with drill and screws. And he went around to different people and gave them something practical to do. You know, they could help screw the lid onto the coffin. Those kinds of things are always helpful. So that was, and I brought in one of those bouquets before the lid was on. I brought in, just spontaneously brought in a bouquet of roses and handed them out to everyone. So we strewed the roses in with the girls. So that was the last that we saw of them. And then there was a funeral that afternoon. It was a Monday. The whole school was there. The choir sang. And after the funeral, we had a more informal circle where people shared and we sang more. And it was really lovely. So that's, that's the story of what happened in Harlemville, you know, up to that point.
I'm so struck by you using the words beauty and wonder, referring to that time. As painful as it must have been to also have that experience of beauty and wonder and connecting with those young people and everyone else in the community and feeling the peace, coming up with these sort of spontaneous rituals, the dancing and the adding of the flowers to the coffins before they're sealed.
Yes, I was really, I was so filled with wonder on the one hand around this whole event. You know, it was devastating, but there was so much wonder in it. And by the way, that is why I named my book Laughing in a Waterfall, because I wanted to indicate that it was about the wonder, because part of it was very early on, I was overwhelmed by the fact, you know, some of these wondrous things that we were already finding out. For one thing, that the girls got themselves to that place for this accident to occur. Well, these things we found out later, so maybe I'll read to you one thing. But I felt honored to be Nina's parent somehow, that these were really great souls who had come to us and lived this short life and then left. And, you know, they have so much become teachers in a way for so many people, because Linda and I, most actively, and Dennis also, have helped many people have a home vigil. And really, that is the best way to find out that this is what you might want for yourself or your loved ones, because it's so hard for people who think in the ways we're taught to think and are used to doing things, you know, call a funeral director right away and say goodbye to the body right away. And, you know, that's it. Sometimes people can't get beyond that to really see that you could do something differently. It just helps so much to experience it. So in the Minnesota Threshold Network, this organization that we helped found, we have had opportunities where people asked us to help them hold a vigil. And so other people who were interested could come and take a shift sitting with the body, like overnight or sometime, you know, to give the family a break so that they could experience it too, even though it wasn't their own loved one. But then
it's so generous of the family members whose loved one it is to offer that to other people. Come have this experience. We want to share this with you so that you know what your choices are.
Yeah. I just can't find really quick this little paragraph that I wrote, that once you're in it and doing it, it's not like creepy and scary. It's like, oh, well, this is a body and this is a box and we have to figure out how to make them fit and look beautiful. So it was like, it all felt very natural and just like practical, one side of it. So again, even if you haven't, you know, experienced a home vigil and you're maybe coached through it, there's something that allows you to have the strength to do it and for it to feel natural and okay to be doing it like that.
It is so empowering. I say that often when I'm talking with people about this, but how empowering it is to be physically engaged with the different processes that are necessary to keep a body at home and care for it there, as well as giving yourselves the time to really come to terms with the loss. Like, all of that is so empowering and so different from what we've become accustomed to, where someone else takes care of all of that for you. And then you sort of like figure out your grief process,
yep,
you know, disconnected to the actual focus of your grief and where it's, you know, where it resides.
Yeah.
So I haven't read your book yet, but I did read the preface on Amazon, and you open it with the opening page, yeah, of Nina's journal.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away by that. She is just astonishing in her clarity and her spaciousness and her generosity of inviting readers to experience joy and wonder, you know, in her journal.
Yeah. The last little bit of that is, to they that find themselves drawn to this book, Read it with freedom and let it be a joy to you.
I mean, that's amazing. What kind of...
I know. What teenager does that?
Journals are so personal. And for her to like kind of get that her experience is going to be something worth sharing and that others can learn from.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that she got this journal when she graduated from eighth grade. She didn't write in it until the year before. So she had started like in 1995.
The year before she died.
Which is also kind of interesting. But can I take the liberty to read something else that we found later that just is another mind-blowing thing?
Absolutely. Please
do. So Nina collected art postcards that people would send her, and she would put them up on her wall in her room, just where it meets the ceiling, you know, liming the whole border of her room. So she had those in the room in New York. And so I brought them home and put them up in her room in our house. Well, one day in February, I was in there and this card drops on the floor. And of course, I had put it up there, but I hadn't read the inside. And Linda, I told her later about it when I described that the front of the card was a picture of two little girls in their wellies in a mud puddle. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, Kirsten bought that card before she left for Nina's birthday, which was October 17th. But the date that she wrote this was November 28th, 1996. So Linda said she must have forgotten to give it to Nina. And then on Thanksgiving Day, which was the 28th, she must have written this card to Nina.
Wow.
So we'll see if I can get through it. This can still bring me to tears. All this, a couple of times here, I've had to squelch the tears as I was speaking. And they died on November 29th. Just so this is written on the 28th. To Nina, my love. Listening to two of us, parentheses, Beatles, joy fills me, shimmers through me, knowing that although we've made so many thousands of sunny or cloudy memories together, quote, the road that stretches out ahead, unquote, will be so much longer. So many adventures and loves and laughter and tears and sorrow. Just so much life lies before us. The two of us. How we will grow strong and beautiful, even more than we are now, and become grannies together, rosy, apple-cheeked, cloudy-haired grandmothers who will tell stories to the grandbabies about iced grapefruit chapstick and mousse, and about our childhood loves and losses, about the hours and days spent together, the years, the centuries, two girls becoming women. Just a little insert here. Our two families had gone on a backpacking trip in Montana that summer, and we were always joking about the names given to chapstick, and we did see moose. So that's what that was about. So now I will go on. And then we'll cackle at each other with twinkling eyes and laugh till we cry. And then when they all go to sleep or go away, we'll slip on our Converse and go dancing the night away under the moonlight. But that is many years, many miles away. Our feet will dance over so much earth. Our ears hear so much music. Our hands touch so many people. Our hearts love so much. And I'll see you golden and glowing with babies, and me too, perhaps. And the world will be a little bit better because of us, even if our names are forgotten after our death. But death won't stop us. It's only another lake to swim, another slight climb before the next mountain peak. But till then, till tomorrow, I'll remember to love the snow, and you'll begin to love skirts over sorrels, and the world and life will hold us like a mother. Happy life, dear sister. Kirsten.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely speechless. Death being another lake we'll swim in. Another slight incline.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. There's just so much love and hope and
fearlessness.
It's just incredible.
This is why I say, you know, on some level of their being, this was all in the plan, in their plans for their lives. Together.
Together. Do you feel like Nina's, that her writing inspired you to write your journey?
Not really. I never thought of it in those terms. I do write in a journal now and then. It's not a daily thing like it was for Kirsten. She was also a journal writer and a poet. And actually Linda published a book of Kirsten's poetry and paintings and drawings. She was an incredible artist in so many ways. So I wrote, you know, I wrote in my journal throughout the whole process. And okay, here's how the story of the writing goes. So we were up visiting Camp Hill Village around Christmas time, and they celebrate the Holy Nights, so the 12 Holy Nights after Christmas. And they had a theme, and the theme was thresholds. So I started thinking about this theme. Well, there's the threshold of birth, and there's the threshold of death. And I started thinking of an experience that we had had that summer as a threshold event. That is where the name Laughing in a Waterfall comes. My husband, Dennis, and I, and our younger son, who was five or six when we took this camping trip, and we hiked along this theme, you know, kind of walking on the boulders, leaping across the boulders, you know, Soren just loved it. And we walked up and up until we came from above to a waterfall. And then we kind of hiked down the other side and where the falls were falling down. And we saw this like person-sized waterfall, and the sun was shining down, and, you know, there was this pool of water beyond where the falls came. And we all kind of looked at each other and said, shall we? And I just said, yes. So we all took off our clothes. We had our swimsuits on. We, the three of us, got in this waterfall. And all we could do was laugh. We just laughed and laughed as the water just pounded down on us. And when we had enough, we came out and we were sitting at the side of this pool, letting the sun and the beauty of this experience soak in. And Dennis just said, I can just see Nina at the top of that waterfall smiling down at us. So this image of the threshold is like, should we get under that waterfall? We don't know. It might be way too cold and we won't be able to stand it. We don't know how it will be. But let's just dare and do it. And so once you make that decision, you're there across the threshold. And then all this blessing pours down upon you. So I don't know. It seemed like from that time on, I was writing this book in my head. And I named it. And I actually had the kind of in my head the outline of the chapters and what their names would be. And it wasn't until the next fall when Soren went off to first grade that I actually had any time to myself. So many mornings after Soren was in school, I'd sit and write. And, you know, you do read in the preface how I was going through the grieving process all over again. This was 99, so it was the third year after she had died.
I feel like your process as healing as it was for you to write that down, it's also such a gift for others to be able to read. And in much the same way that Nina invited the reader to find joy and freedom in reading her words, you're also offering that, and also the hope of healing through writing your grief journey down.
Yeah, I really had to talk with my family, you know, do we really want to put all this out here? Because there's very little that I don't include. But, you know, I'm going, well, that's what a memoir is all about. It's hearing the inside of somebody's life that you don't see from the outside. So, yeah, you can learn all about us in this book.
It's a bold thing. You have to enter into fearlessness to honestly be able to write.
Yeah, I also wanted to document everything because I had this sense, you know, my life is so much, this is before Nina died and this is after Nina died. And already after 3 years, you know, I knew that everything that happened around this whole event would become kind of fuzzy. And I wanted to record all the details as I remembered them, and also for my sons, so that they would know the stories too as they became adults.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for another opportunity to share this story.
A Path Home is a production of the National Home Funeral Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating and advocating for communities and families who choose to care for their own loved ones at death. Check out our website at homefuneralalliance.org. If you like this podcast, be sure to tell a friend and subscribe and review wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to share your home funeral or natural burial experience on the podcast, please email me at podcast@homefuneralalliance.org. We'd love to hear from you. The music at the beginning and end of A Path Home is written and performed by Sarah Cruz. Our beautiful cover art is by Linda Curray. And until next time, remember the words of Ram Dass. We are all walking each other home.
I want to be to walk you home. I'll tend to your body, you'll tend to my soul. And if it happens the other way around, I know you'll gently lay me in the ground and take the next breath. Take me.